are listening to Nakedly Examined Music, a podcast about songs and songwriters. My name is Mark Lintonmeyer. My guest for episode 218 is Pat Mastellato. He started as an L.A. session drummer in the mid-70s, playing, among others, with Kenny Loggins, Patti LaBelle, the Pointer Sisters, and Al Jarreau. He was then a founding member of Mr. Mister, recording four albums with them through 1990. Through this time and afterwards, he was still doing session work with XTC, the Sugar Cubes, Hall & Oates, the Rembrandts. He played on the Friends theme song, Matthew Sweet, Eddie Money, many more. Then there was a turning point in his career where he joined the new double trio lineup of King Crimson in 1994. You're right now listening to Vroom Vroom from their album Thrack, 1995. And he persisted through the various incarnations of that until they broke up in 2021. He's played with various King Crimson-related spin-offs, including Stickmen with Tony Levin and one of my past guests here, Marcus Reuter. When Tony is busy playing with Peter Gabriel, others, then he and Marcus play with Trey Gunn instead as Tuner, and he's involved with many other projects. Today, we're going to talk about the song 31 from Tuner from their 2023 album T1 Contact Information. Then Flinch by the initial iteration of Tuner, which is just Pat and Marcus from 2005's Totem album. Then we'll look back to his first writing credit, Life Goes On by Mr. Mister from their first album, I Wear the Face, 1984. And we'll conclude by listening to Prague Noir by Stickmen from 2016. For more information, please see patmastellato.com. For more about this podcast, see nakedlyexaminedmusic.com. And to support the effort, go to patreon.com/nakedlyexaminedmusic. So I will have played a little bit of Vroom Vroom by King Crimson from Thrack, 1995. It seems this was a key transition point in your career. And actually the first time I saw you live, because on that double trio tour with you playing with one of my former guests, Bill Bruford, as well as one of my other former guests, Trey Gunn, was an incredible show. Any thoughts about that transition from playing with Mr. Mister, doing all these session work, playing on my favorite XTC album, playing on the Friends soundtrack, all this stuff, to becoming, you know, an icon in the prog rock universe? A participant, let's say.
I'm a privileged participant. I'm very happy. I mean, it's a dream band to me growing up. You know, Crimson was like the Beatles, and few other bands had that caliber, consistent music. So it just something that I never could have dreamt would ever happen. You know, I met Robert sort of through an audition with David Sylvian. We got along good for a tour we did together. And then he called and invited me into Crimson. So I was shocked. Getting back to Vroom Vroom, we had a vroom. When Robert put that double trio Crimson together, he had, Vroom and Thrack were the main two pieces that he presented. And then came Vroom Vroom, a reinterpretation. And what I find interesting about Vroom Vroom is it has a coda. Many of these songs in Crimson have a coda. And the coda to Vroom Vroom was a situation where we'd cut the track Vroom Vroom. We went in the control room at Real World Records and listened. And we said, that's good. And Robert says, okay, now I want to do a coda. Everybody grab a pencil and a piece of paper. And I forget exactly the chords and the number of beats, but for instance, he said, I want you to play G for 7 beats, and then D for 9 beats, and then E for 12 beats, then we'll play 3 bars. So he laid out this chord progression with a number of bars to it, and we went in and played it as an improvisation. Now, when we finished that take, I felt really good. I think I nailed everything he requested in his explanation. And when it had finished and the cymbals had quieted down, I went, yeah! And then we came in the control room and I found out nobody else was happy. So I suggested, what if you guys go overdub and I'll keep what I played? And I did, and they did. So if you hear on the very end of that tune, a little voice that goes, yeah, that was me from the other room where my drums were.
Very cool. So a number of these subsequent bands that you've been have been, I don't know if you consider them King Crimson spinoff projects, but we're about to hear one from your recent album, from Tuner, T-U-N-E-R, not to be confused with Tuner without the dash, which we'll talk about later, but that is you and Trey Gunn, you know, of King Crimson fame, but then the Tuner without the dash was you and Marcus Reuter, another person that I've had on the show, who, I don't know, seeing you guys live last fall in Milwaukee, to me, that was like, okay, I'm basically seeing King Crimson. I know there's no voices. I know there's no Robert Fripp. You know, you're able to cover those parts. Any thoughts about, you know, that you had the two, the collaboration with Trey Gunn, and then the tuner, the collaboration with Marcus, and now all three of you together. And then I should mention Stickmen, that we'll hear a little later, which is Tony Levin instead of Trey Gunn. So another sort of King Crimson variation. Do you see these projects as sort of a branching from that or no?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, you can call them a Crimson spinoff. That's okay. They've all got their own issues, but the ethics of all the bands sort of stayed true to the Crimson theme. What Robert asked of me in the very beginning was always play it like it's the first time. So for a musician, a lot of times you're playing this song on stage over and over again, and pretty soon it becomes a bit predictable. So I love that Robert likes this idea that you're always in the moment and you're always trying to find a genuine performance that's coming through in the moment, not thought about and conceived that much, but just the way it rolls out. And that's certainly the way it works with Tuner. And the confusion over the name, I forget the sequence of events, but I had a thing I did. I started to make my own records on the side in the 90s. And I think one of the first ones was Mastica. And I thought that was a good name because it put it next to Mastelotto. I didn't want to put my name on it, but this gave me a way to. So then I can't remember. Oh, well, I did the one with Trey that we called Two, T-U. Mm-hmm. And that was after we had finished The Power to Believe. We had some little ideas. We said, I'll go up to Trey's place in Seattle. He shared a loft with the drummer, Matt Chamberlain. And so I got to use Matt's gear. And we recorded that in a few days or a week up there with my buddy, Bill Munyon, and then edited it and put that record out. And I said, Trey, we should get a name for this. And I suggested we use Two, spelt T-U, and then try to find two other musicians. So we could be the two of us touring, but every night would be different because there would be two different musicians. If we were playing Texas, maybe we could get a couple Roadhouse blues players. If we play up in Canada, maybe we can get Daniel Lanois to come over and sit in. My first connection was with Kimmo Pahoin, the Finlandish accordion player, because he had a duo with Kimmo and Samuli. Kosaman is the percussionist that played with him, that also plays with Moom and Bjork and these other things. So this would be a great combination, and they were really into it. So that became K2, K-T-U, like Kimmo plus two.
Sure.
And then I think I did Tunisia. I did the theremin player, Pamela Kirsten. You mentioned that track about the use of black and some of the tracks. That's a very beatbox-driven record. We did it late night here at my place a couple times when I flew her into my place in Texas. But I was trying to keep something consistent with the two. So in those days, there were record stores. You'd want to be able to search through and find the same artist in the same, you know, like when I'm looking for King Crimson and I find King Creole, you know, it gets me there. So I was looking to find some consistent moniker, and that was the two. Then I made a record with Marcus that we called it Tuner. So when this situation came up with Trey and Marcus, because we knew Tony was going to be busy with Peter Gabriel last year, and we knew about the Beat project coming up this year. So we said, hey, what if we go play some gigs together? What are we going to call it? And it's confusing, but we used two with a dash, ner, to distinguish it from two and tuner. It's really quite fucked up. I'm sorry about that.
Can't just do the jazz thing and call it Mastelotto Gunn Reuter. That would not be.
Well, we've done so many of those. You know, I don't know if you knew, we just did a prog rock cruise about a month ago. That was with Stickmen. And believe it or not, we were one of the first acts up on the big deck, and they lost Tony Levin's stick.
Oh, no.
So what are we going to do? We just boarded the ship like 3 hours ago, and they can't find his instrument. So Marcus and I had to go on with the show. We must go. So Adam Holzman joined us. He was off in the wings, and he volunteered. We found a keyboard for him to play. I don't know if you know Adam, great keyboard player. And Tony continued to run up and down the boat looking for his instrument, which he found about an hour after we were done. But the reason I'm bringing this up, because after we improvised with Adam Holzman, he came back and, okay, I've got the band name. It's Matt. No, Map, Marcus, Adam, and Pat. That's how I got stuck with Comora. That was David Kohler, myself, and Paolo Ranieri, Italian trumpet player. So it's just too many names, too much music, not enough names.
Well, I guess in the electronic world, as long as you put featuring Pat Mastelotto, then I can still find you in if I'm searching on your name. You're featured on many albums.
And I didn't realize that the dash presents problems with the search engine.
It's, yes, it's a different band. Let's get to the music. So 31 was the song you picked from the 2023 album, T1 Contact Information. It's a good 8 minutes long. Can you say a little about it before we hear it and where you were at with this particular lineup?
Well, it's mostly an improv. We've been doing the whole record here at my house that week. based on improvisations. And Trey and Marcus were downstairs doing something. I think my wife had made some cake, and they were down chowing. And I went up to play around with this new program. I'm going to draw a blank. I'm going to have to look for it. I think it's called Melodica, kind of a beatbox program. And I started to mess with that. And I thought, oh, this will be fun. Let's just chop the last beat off of this cycle. So instead of being four bars of 4/4, you're missing the last eighth notes. And that eighth note, and that's why I ended up calling it 31. It's not 32 beats. It's 31 beats. That's why it's got the little skip in it. So once I have my little pattern together, and I yelled out for Marcus and Trey, hey, come up. Let's see if you can play over this thing. And they jammed on it. And right away, I think it was Marcus played this. I said, oh, that's the hook. So I cut and pasted that and repeated it a few times. And we continued to jam a little bit on that. And then I'm not sure, we realized, okay, this will only stand up for like 3 minutes. We need a bridge. So the bridge was a severe left turn, and it all just happened in the room spontaneously with all three of us playing. And then the editing, which happened after the fact, after they went home. And then these were all finally mixed by a friend of Marcus's over in Europe. Eric did a great mix on these pieces. I think we needed something down tempo, you know, something more gangster.
So you're just using the beatbox as your click track, right? You're still actually playing that part.
Yeah, I'm playing some of it. I'd have to listen to remember. My typical MO on these kind of improvs and stuff, if we're doing it here in my house, is I'll put up different beatboxes and get things going because I'm kind of engineer and drummer. So If I'm recording the other guys, I'm in here in the control room. So we might have spent 2 or 3 days jamming like that with me mostly always in the control room recording the guys and making up beatbox patterns, you know, in the control room with them. Then I went out. Actually, after they left, I put the drums on.
Okay.
Put some acoustic drums on. It depends song by song. And the last day that they were here, I went out and played my real drums. That's where the T1 contact information comes from, because they had a vocoder set up. And I had grabbed that. I don't think I've been drinking much this year, but I was feeling festive. So I grabbed the mic and did some shouting in that, and then ran in the other room and played drums. And
yeah, I was wondering if some of this involved looping or layering or something, because there's definitely a feeling of, okay, now I've established this is the drum part. But now I'm going to, so let me in fact insert a clip from 101 where there's a little extra percussion thing added. This little tick, 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 like that sounds like, okay, I have the main thing going. Let me play an additional overdub. But is this done in the live setting?
That little sound came out of the beatbox. I'm going to have to look up the program here. I'm feeling horrible now. I'll find it by the time we're done, the name of the character that sent it to me. It was his brand new invention.
Just the way that you're building the sound palette on this, that you've got definitely real drums, but then there are about 3 other layers. And in particular, at 227, in fact, let me insert another clap, where the drums stop. Yeah, just these little chip bone.
I don't really know, man. I've been known to smoke a little weed, and I usually just do whatever I do and then wake up and go, hey, this sounds okay. We'll keep that and we'll throw this other thing over here away. The program is called Modalix, Modalics. It was one of the first days I pulled it out. So I was just going through patches and hearing sounds. So it was new to me, is what was exciting about it. I guess it was fresh.
Yeah, I wasn't sure, given that you live, at least. I think when I saw you live, you had an electronic drum pad in the middle that wasn't working. So every once in a while, you'd hit it and there would be nothing. But I could tell you were being able to see you. Anyway, it seems like that, going back to even the Mr. days, where you had a lot of, it allowed you to expand the palette of, like, I'm not going to just have a snare. I'm going to have 3 different things that could sort of serve as snare just to make things more interesting and sort of layer against yourself while you're playing live.
Yeah. You know what a side stick is when a drummer plays a cross stick or a side stick.
Mm-hmm.
That sound, it's heavily identified with country and Western music. So I tend to think, well, what's the alternative? Well, we could use a little papery 808, but that's really identified with the hip hop world. So I'm always searching for other alternatives besides the big backbeat, the little backbeat, the ones you need for transitions. For some guys, that's just the dynamics within a snare drum. And for me, that's chasing, you know, drop a bag of coins. And that could be the alternate beat on beat 4. I've recently saw that clip of Michael Jackson. I don't know if you've seen it, where they're describing how he was auditioning snare drum samples for a day or days. And at some point while they were moving something in the studio, a case fell over and crashed on the floor. And he went, that's it. That's the sample I want. And I think it's on Beat It. You know, I've done that in the old days with the Mr. Misters. I pushed over a road case, but we did it intentionally. I said, let's put the road case on the loading bay and put a mic out there and knock it off. And all the shit inside that percussion box, you know, as it crashed, it rattled. And we used that on Welcome to the Real World.
Let me play a couple more little sections. So 245, I'm not sure if this is the bridge you were talking about or whether that's a little later, but the 7-8 measure goes away here. At least there's new chords there. There's this apparent synth sound. This is no longer a Crimson Prague thing. This is a straight ahead hip hop. I don't know.
I don't know either. You know, we don't try to categorize. I mean, we do when we talk to each other. Hey, do that little hip hoppy thing you did yesterday, or do that little two beat polka beat you did yesterday or something. But it's largely in the moment, especially that when you say there was a synth, there was no synths, but the guys do have
sure
so many synth effects for their two instruments. And interesting to me, when you talked about whatever gig you saw last night, I hit a pad that you didn't hear. There's a couple of reasons for that. I don't recall that I had any gear malfunctions, but they do happen. But there's a couple of things. One is if the sound man doesn't put it up in the mix. And on the last tour we did, I gave him separate outputs. Mm. And I think that might be what you're referring to. Sometimes he just gets a stereo send from me, and I do all my blends and my balances from my position. But on the last tour, he said, you know, I want to have your tom-toms, your electric drums separate. I want to have the voice. When you use a voice, I want that on a separate fader. So I extracted those down different channels. The other curious thing he made me think of is sometimes when I'm playing live, if I need to come down on a beat where I have to crash a cymbal, when my hands are busy and I can't play the sample that's needed, I put a pre-roll into it. So I may hit the sample on beat 4, a bar before I need it, and there's silence. And it can play when I don't actually have a hand to hit it. I got to crash a cymbal at that other place. So there's several places when, if you go through my sample, you go, why the fuck is there like a second and a half of pre-roll? Oh, because that's exactly how long it needed to have that event happen on beat 2 of the next bar.
So does that require that the system know what tempo that you're playing at so that it does? Okay, so it's like a, you know, like a delay where you want it to actually be in sync with the...
Just put silence at the beginning of a sample. And that could be a little tiny breath if it just wants to be 8th or 16th before I hit it. But usually I forget after a while. I come back to learn. I go, why did I do it like this? You know, I haven't played with this band for a year. And then I go, oh, now I see what I did. I put this there because actually the sample is on beat 2 of the next bar. You know, so I have to relearn it.
Now we got some ride in here. We're moving things over, and you've got some builds with some toms and some things. It seems like we've covered in general your way of deciding what you're going to do when, but tell me about the editing, like in actually getting to this, the ride section part. Did that happen because, you know, you had 20 minutes of stuff to work from and, you know, you thought this is a standout part, I'm going to move it over here? Or was this, how much stuff are you editing down to what here, to 8 minutes?
I can't remember exactly on that one. I'd have to pull up the file. I think we did it all in the same set. In fact, I'm sure we did it all in the same session. So we probably had used that first theme enough and we knew we needed another theme. So it was in this, you know, I'll call it a reel, but it was in the same session. I'm a Pro Tools guy. So for me, it was in the same Pro Tools session. I just pushed it off to the right-hand side and we started something new. That's probably what we did. I'm not positive, but we probably did it that way. And then we attached them back so that we could continue to play over the theme. You know what I mean? We could continue to play over it as a 6 or 8 minute piece instead of two pieces. That's most likely, but I'd have to look into the session. But I don't think it was two completely different sessions pasted together. I think we did it all in the same. And in fact, I'm sure we did because they carry on with the same sounds from that program I just got.
You were saying originally it seemed like this would only stand up for 3 minutes. You got a solid 5 minute song here. And then the last 3 minutes are more guitar solo, basically. You had established a nice solid foundation. And then there was just room for the lead instrument to go and go and go. Any thought about how you're editing your friends in terms of how long their solos get to go? Obviously, when you're playing this live, I don't know, is this one that might spend 15 minutes, 20 minutes if you're doing this live?
Well, live, there's no way to stop them. They've got their back to me looking at their instruments. Best I can do is just sort of try and, you know, drop out and see if that indicates any change for those guys. Editing the guitar players, I don't edit them a lot. I might do full band edits, but individual edits, I would leave to Trey or Marcus to do themselves. They both know the computer well enough, they could jump in the hot seat. Trey did a couple times. He said, oh, I want to fix this. And he just jumped into the seat and find the spot that he didn't like and punch himself in or whatever he did. Marcus tends to do it after the fact. He'll go back. He mostly works in Ableton Live. So he'll move into Ableton. I think for sure there's at least one that I definitely edited, which was T1, because it was, I don't think this track 31 was that long when we did it. I think we're somewhere in the 10-minute range. But this T1 jam, that was like a 30-minute jam. It had a drone behind it. So before we sent it over to Eric to mix, I had tried to chop that down from like whatever, 25, 30 minutes to like 10 minutes. So I took some big chunks out. I was referencing the performance of everybody, not just the drone. So after the fact, Marcus made me aware that I fucked up and cut the drone in the middle of its phrase. So it's a bit of a story, but I took some samples of that drone and used them on stage when we tour. And that's when the guys realized, this isn't good what you've done, Pat. You gave us like a 6-bar phrase or 11-bar phrase, or I mean, 4 variations, and they're all different. So this is my way when we're playing live and improvising that I can drop in similar things. They're basically in the same key, but they don't follow the same chord progression. And that's where I screwed up when I chopped it.
Well, let's get a second song out there. You'd recommended Flinch from the Totem album by Tuner without the hyphen. So it's just you and Marcus Reuter. And this is a very compact, fast, funky one, 3.5 minutes. Totem was the second, 2005, is that right? Originally, was the second one you did together? Was Paul was first, or was this the...
No, Totem was the first record we did together. In fact, if we carried on, I don't know if you got the joke, but Totem to Paul, Totem Paul. Mm-hmm. Paul was our second record. Next record was Face, Paul Face. And Pole Dancer. We were looking for different ways to have the titles of the records spell out a story as we grew. But Flinch was one of the first things we did. I had met Marcus on a train over in Germany. I was traveling with Trey Gunn actually to a Crimson show. And he walked by and Trey knew him and jumped up and said, hey. So I talked to him a little bit then. I got some of his music. And it was a year or two later, I did some stuff for him for Centrazoon, one of his projects. I did some remixing and played on some different things. Then I heard this record that he did called Pure. It's a record he did with Ian Boddy. And I really loved that record. And I had just gone through a divorce, so my house was empty and Crimson had stopped. This was in 2004, I guess. So I reached out to Marcus. I says, hey man, you want to come to the States? I've got an empty house, but I still have my studio. The furniture's all gone, you know. The wife is gone, but my daughter and I stayed in the house. And Marcus came over to join us, and we did some improvising and songwriting and started the project that became Tuner. It was interesting there because I think we were both using Ableton. I don't think we were in Pro Tools. I think we were all in Ableton. And I had done, I call it glitch editing. I'm not really sure what the technical term is, but when you hyper edit things. I did some of that on Level 5 and some other stuff I forget in the late 90s or early 2000s. So Flinch, I don't think I played anything on Flinch. I programmed it and then I did a fucking lot of little tiny edits and learning. I did it as so much of what I do is really research and development. It's like an exploration, like, oh, I want to do something. Go, let's see how, oh, well, we can make it actually go up in bit. Dreet. If you cut them closer together, as you cut them closer, it appears that they go up in pitch. It's just slivers. I don't do it mathematically. They're not eighth notes or quarter notes. Like I noticed when Machine did some glitch editing that he did on the track Level 5, he used 32nd notes and 64th notes. And I was like, no, I don't do that. I just do slivers. I do bigger and, you know, smaller and smaller slivers. So it'll go drrr. So in fast contact, right?
Before I play the Flinch here, just to not let this pass. So Level 5, King Crimson. So you were allowed to get behind the desk to do, even though this is sort of notoriously fripping control, whatever. It was part of it that you were not just a drummer, that you were allowed to actually get in your editing mode, even with that project.
Yeah, with Crimson, any of us could be at the desk. It wasn't just Robert. In fact, Robert doesn't sit there besides to listen. It doesn't grab faders very often that I can ever recall. But the thing about this was we actually did it at my house and Robert wasn't there. Machine, who co-produced and engineered the record with us, we wanted to have some pre and post-production time. I did and Machine did as producer. He didn't get pre-production time. We had 2 rehearsals with him before he went in the studio. So I had a few days with him before that. I said, hey, man, you're going to have to get ready for this material because there's a lot of drop beats. And he's like, oh, I want to work on the grid. I want to put everything on the grid. I said, well, that's going to be tough for you because we have tempo fluctuations and a lot of meter changes. So we worked in the beginning, Machine and I, with Trey, and we used some of our live tapes. I said, listen, Machine, it always feels like it slows down here. When we would originally do a song like Level 5, I've programmed some stuff in those days with propeller heads. I forget what that was called, their program that had just came out. So we were writing Level 5 in Adrian's basement at moderate volume, not with a drum set. So I was using drum machine stuff so we could all have a conversation. Hey, let's do four of these. Let's do this. Oh, let's try that part here. We could do all that at low volume. And then we went out and played the song live and I added the real drums. But in the back of my head from always, I had this hyper drummer, square pusher, faux tech kind of electronica drum thing in my head. And when I hooked up with Machine, so when we would play live, I would just shut the machine on and off. We didn't used to play with a click at all. Anything I did up until maybe a couple of years ago, maybe once I started working with Gavin, we brought in a click. But before that, I would program something and just play to it. I would just hear it. And I would just hope my tempo was close. You know, maybe it doesn't come in for the first verse. So I play a verse with my own tempo. And then when I drop the loop or sample or a phrase in, I hope I'm in good enough time. And I can hear and I can go, oh shit, I'm a little ahead of it. I got to hold back or I got to push ahead to make this little sample fit in. So when we went to record Level 5, that's when I said, check it out here, Machine. When we play this live, I take out the drum machine here. I take it out and I put it in. I take it out. And every time in this one thing, as we go to the solo, it slows down. So I know Fripp, Robert, must want it slower because Robert's by himself. It's a section just before the last solo where it kind of breaks down and it's a heavy guitar riff and it slows down. So Machine and I wrote a tempo map that went up and down and up and down. And we practiced with Trey and we said, yep, I think it feels right. So when Adrian and Robert showed up for their only pre-production rehearsal, those 2 days with Machine, they didn't realize that I had made a tempo map. So the first test for us was we could hear the click, Machine, Trey, and I, and we play the song and see if the guys ever feel like, oh, something's weird. If they look back like something's edgy, and they didn't. We got through the whole piece. And they didn't realize that we had created this tempo map to it. So there was a lot of other production work done on the side while the record was being made. And part of that was I said, Machine, we got to get these glitch edits done. And they're not happening with everybody in the room. There's other things we're going to work on. So he came to my place in Texas after we had finished in Nashville recording. Machine came to me in Texas for maybe 5 days. And we primarily worked on Level 5 and, well, we call it Power Circle then. It shows up on the record as The Power to Believe. But it's the section which has the bass line, doing, doing, bang, doing, bing, dong, bomb, ding, dong, ding, ding, dong, bomb. That weird bass line. So I knew I needed to move the drums around that. So I did all that stuff with the machine here at my house. And then when we came back to mix in Nashville, Robert hadn't heard any of that stuff. So he heard it for the first time while the mixes were going down.
If folks want to pause this, actually on Trey Gunn's episode, we discussed Level 5 specifically. So I didn't want to put that in this one, but that's excellent additional information. Let's finally hear Flinch. We'll be right back. not played at all. But, you know, this is really interesting when you have a drummer, a very good drummer, who has the drummer's imagination and the drummer's sort of hand memory. I don't know. Yeah, when you're putting together an electronic track like this, are you trying to transcend what you would do with your hands, or are you sort of just doing what you would do with your hands, but like it's just in a different way?
Yeah, I think transcend is a good word because I'm limited. My capabilities, my drumming chops are limited, especially since COVID hit. It's just unbelievable to me what's happening in the drummer world and all the musicians' world since 2020. The caliber of musicianship, so many people stayed home and woodshed it, really practiced. I don't really work like that. You mentioned earlier, maybe I'm more like a painter. I put something up and I look at it and I look for shadings and colorings. And essentially, you use your technique to achieve your imagination. But if my technique can't achieve my imagination, I want to find a workaround. And that's what I do. I hear something in my head and I can't physically play it. I'm going to find another way to get it on tape if that's what we as a band or a project want, you know?
That's really interesting then that you started in Crimson with Bill Bruford when on this show, he described sort of how he sees his bands as letting the racehorses free. Like, let's watch the racehorses do their thing. So it's all very much real time in the moment, not a lot of stepping back and painting shades on it. It is about the visceral, the athletic activity.
That's great. And I'm all for that too. I mean, I'll always take a performance that has what spontaneity and energy and vibe and all those things over perfection, actual metronomic perfection. It's a wonderful, fascinating field, this music. You know, you can go so many different directions with it.
Around a minute in, things just start stopping in a way that there's no way that this would be an improv of the two of you and stopping with this level of discipline. Let me just play a little bit from that part. Like, it seems pretty clearly like, okay, this was done in the mixing phase.
Absolutely. I did a lot of chopping and a lot of times you cut all the verbs off. You cut all the other instruments or all the reverbs off. Or a trick I learned with Machine is when you glitch edit, everything gets louder because you've multiplied the density of notes in that space. So the volume levels jump up. So what I usually do is I go back through and they call it regaining. I restructure the levels. So these things that I've edited that became louder, I bring them back down and, you know, what you want to call it, burn it, you know, make it into one piece instead of a bunch of little edits. And in fact, sometimes Pro Tools, I can do so many edits that Pro Tools will crash because there's just too many. So I need to, you know what I mean? You need to bake it, you know, into one thing and then carry on doing more edits. But the interesting thing Machine does when he does those is he only glitch edits the close mics, not the room mics. It's like a lot of times I want to take a real drummer, me, myself, and how can I be a cyber drummer? How can I do these things that I can't really do? I can't play 30-second notes, but I can edit 30-second notes. So sometimes it's my own performance. That's the case of Level 5. Played it and then chopped my own stuff up. Flinch track was really tight, small sounds that I had in some beatbox, a company then called M Audio. M Audio put out quite a few sample libraries that weren't very popular. I forget the host device. I don't think they make it anymore, but they had Middle Eastern instruments. And like one of the things you mentioned, it was samples of Dennis Chamber. Dennis Chamber's really tight on the use of black. Those were Dennis Chamber's, maybe there were 10 loops in that package that they sent me. And so I use those sometimes cut up in different ways or sometimes right on top of each other.
Let's hear a couple more of those little sounds. So I wrote down cricket percussion at 117. Let's see what this is. Oh, so I'm not even sure if this is you or this is something Marcus was doing. Like,
you know, I'm not positive myself. It's been too many days gone by.
Let me play another one. I wrote lawnmower noises. Let's see what this is.
I think that is actually the drum components, but they're so sliced up. You know, like I say, if you slice, like you slice it an inch, say, let's use big pieces. If you sliced it an inch and told it, you know, this is a snare drum hit. You slice an inch and tell it to repeat maybe 10 times, and then you shave a third of that off and tell it to repeat 5 more times, and shave a third more of that off and tell it 10 more times, and a third more 10 more times. And then you put in 10 more that are reversed. I would reverse some of them or pitch shift them. They have these slower downer effects. So sometimes within the glitching, it'll go, it'll slur and go down. You call them iguana noises or whatever. Like Wookiee. Had other gigs where they do the Wookiee sounds, you know. It just get inside the computer and fuck with sounds. They call it, what is Stephen Wilson gives me credit of? Sound design. Sound design.
There you go.
I do a lot of sound design to my drums. Sometimes even within what I quite like, it's in a few, you'd search a long time to find this, but within a drum performance, a live performance, sometimes I'll take individual snare hits and put that slower downer on them. So if there's a doom, da bat, da doom, da bat, da doom, da boom, there's one backbeat that's got a pitch shift in it. And maybe it's every eighth time or just in a special moment before a break. You'll hear that kind of stuff on the ORK record. I know I did some of that there. And those guys, they never notice. You know, when you hit a snare drum, there's so many sounds, whether you hit it in the middle of the side and whether the lug is detuning. And you can actually, we try to do this with XTC. We used what they called in those days, it was a Kai sampler. They had a word for it. It wasn't bending the note, but Andy Partridge sometimes wanted the drums to be in tune with the track, but we wanted them to bend to the note because a lot of times you hit it,
like a talking drum.
Yeah, a little bit, but within a typical American Western drum set, those backbeats, crack, crack, gonk. You get some, you know, like Bruford plays with a wide open, really bonky snare drum that a lot of sound engineers hate. You know, his honk, honk, and his snare. I love it. I go for that.
So does that mean he has to retune to every song, you know, to like make it in the key?
No, but you can actually learn different places where you hit the drum. Different lug is going to sound a little, hit it there, hit it there. Sometimes you find, well, that's the sweet spot. And then you realize later the sweet spot because that little corner of the drum was detuned enough to be in key with the song. I didn't realize it was just the sweet spot. I could hear it sounded better than hitting it over on the other side of the head. I work with some people who work with the Stones. They said, Charlie does that all the time. He finds a spot on his drum where the pitch changes and it fits in a little better.
Let me play one section right toward the end of the song where I think this is what Marcus was doing earlier, but probably that you took it and filtered the crap out of it. Let's just see if I'm right here. So just all these, I'm hearing enough gestures from his that's making me think like that you took that and did something with it. I don't know. Do you even recall at this point?
I'm pretty sure I recognize that sound. And that is just if you go about 2 octaves up or 3 octaves up. So you've repitched an instrument. Depending on the sampler, they do the weird aliasing. And, you know, it can't really reproduce the sound. I don't really know, but the digital that takes so many little snapshots of what 48K, your 48,000 snapshots, there's too many nuances in there for it to grab everything. But what I think that is in Ableton, when you crank things up an octave, 2, 3, 4 octaves higher, they get that sound you just played for me. So I don't know if it started as Marcus's part or one of my parts, but I think that's just pitched up a lot inside Ableton. If I pitched it up in Pro Tools, it wouldn't be like that. It's like this weird, notchy, knocky sound that Ableton achieves. It's weird that I've done a few projects where we can work in Pro Tools, Logic, and Ableton, and they all sound different. You know, in the old days, it was whether you're working on a Mitsubishi or those were digital machines, but before that, the analog machines, Studer or Stevens, an MCI machine, they all sound different. You know, when you get into the nuances of, you know, you kind of hear it in Elton John's records that he used a lot of MCI tape recording. You hear Queen or somebody and they got the Stevens or the Studer sound. So
let me play just the very end of the track here. I guess the thing I wanted to call attention to, which I don't think we could really hear as I was playing it through the mic, you know, it stops mostly with this light bouzouki like sound that Marcus is doing, but it has a little bit of drum. It does it like a like just very, very faintly off to the side, as if you were, I don't know. It was just a nice subtle ending, I thought.
I'm a stoner, man. I'm making Pink Floyd records for myself, is all I can tell you. So yeah, I definitely love to hear sounds travel around and disappear and go back into the mix or come forward in the mix. And you started to mention once that this thing was about songwriting. A lot of times I'm not a proper songwriter, you know. I help get the whole package together. And I think there's some validity to including the production and the sound of a record as the composition.
Sure.
In the world I grew up in my generation, I think that they are very, very closely tied. You know, Hendrix on a kazoo would not be the thing that gets me excited.
Running a farm, you rely on your equipment daily. Downtime isn't just an annoyance, it cuts profit. At Quinn Ag Products, we have the genuine ag co-parts you need to stay busy. Get faster fixes, fewer delays, and more time doing what you do best. Plus, get expert assistance from our team. Call 888-987-8466 or stop by a Quinn location to order genuine Agco parts now.
In particular, on a maybe improvisational, but in any case, an instrumental sound design, to arbitrarily say with copyright law, well, you can only, it's only the melody and the words, and there are no words. So it's the melody? Well, what counts as the melody on what we just played there?
Yeah.
Like, that's the melody? That's, it seems like the whole thing, especially the gestures that you're saying. So this is a transition to, we wanted to play something from earlier in your career, Life Goes On, the final track from the first album by Mr. Mister, I Wear the Face, 1984. This is the one on this album that you have a writing credit on. You've got increasingly more later, but it sounds like just from the beginning of the song, like that your intro riff is a foundation for the song.
Sure, sure. That's on the first record we did together. So when I met those guys, Rich and Slug, the Misters, and they already had Steve Ferris, the guitar player, they'd been playing with him for about a year, and they'd been auditioning drummers, and they'd bought a Lindrum machine to continue working in songwriting. And when I auditioned for them, they high-fived and told me, come back tomorrow. I was like in the band immediately. Years later, I asked Rich, how could you guys hire me? Like, you didn't even have a conversation, go out of the room and come back or call me tomorrow. They said, dude, you were the first guy who could play along with the Lindrum and get to the end of the song. So subsequently, I'm in the band and they gave me the Lindrum. They said, here, you take this home. We don't need it anymore. We got you. So now I've got a Lindrum. I never had a beatbox like that before. And I'm programming and doing things. And I come into rehearsal one day and Rich is jumping up and down playing a riff. And he goes, oh, dude, that thing you put in the beatbox, that's great, great. We just high-fived. We just wrote a song, man. And I go, what are you talking about? He said, well, your conga part, the thing you did with the low drums, that there's the... So anyway, that beatbox thing and what I had played inspired the bass riff, and the song grew from there to be written. As a drummer, you don't think about this. The manager came and Richard Page said, George, Pat's a co-writer on this one. Go get him a publishing deal. Publishing? What's he talking about? I'm just lucky to have a record deal, be in a band, to have a gig. You know, a week or two later, George picked me up like 10 grand in advance. You get an advance? We haven't even put the record out yet. Yeah, you got an advance for co-writer on that. Wow. So that's that track on that record. But Mr. Band evolved to where by the second record, we were writing most of the songs in a room together like that. Not just one guy bringing in a song, but all of us. Richard Page, he lived up in La Cañada then, but he rented a place like in down at the water, like a big beach house. And we'd all go down there with the wives and kids and just have the kids would all be out having fun outside. And we'd have our drum machines and instruments in the house and be songwriting. So I'm just saying that the band had really great camaraderie in those days, and we'd get together often to songwrite, almost daily. And if the songs weren't feeling like they were right for the Misters, that's how some of these other things I was involved with playing on, Al Jarreau, Pointer Sisters, Patti LaBelle. These are tracks that we didn't feel were kind of right for Mr. Mister, but they could be spun off to other artists. Sometimes they continue to use our track, our basic demos sometimes became, that's so common now that the demo, you're doing a demo on a 24 track machine. So it really is a master and you just continue to overdub, you know?
Well, that's an effort free way to network on your part, is just having your parts being taken off and used by other, I'm on this record now. Like, did you meet the...
Well, I tell you another one that I'd forgotten entirely about. We had a song called Watching the World, and we cut our version of it. And there was a later version by Chaka Khan that Arif Martin did, and Phil Collins played drums on it. But I saw someone say, hey, you got a credit on there. I said, well, I got a credit. Phil played drums. Well, somewhere my beatbox is still in there. Something I program, I guess, isn't inside that track.
All right, well, let's hear Life Goes On. So you're saying you didn't even come up with that with your hands. That was just you playing with the dun, dun, dun.
No, I did. And I can tell you even where it was inspired from a drummer perspective is James Brown. You would never know that. But I used to rent my drums as a working musician, young man in LA, any way you could get a gig. You know, I worked as I loaded trucks or sat, you know, holding a spot on Cliff Richards or, you know, whatever gig I could get. And one of the gigs, one night, a friend of mine, there's a club out in the valley, San Fernando Valley, and they had James Brown for two nights. And he called and he said, hey, I need to get a third set of drums for James Brown. He wants to play drums tonight. So I took over these drums and sat side stage when they pushed them out. And the two drummers are playing and James sits down to play and he plays eighth notes with his bass drum, not four on the floor. And that's what I'm doing in that song. I'm going, that's all James Brown played. He sat down to play eighth notes with his That's what James, that was James's backbeat. He just played left hand and kick drum while he's, and he never left that beat. And it just stuck with me. And I go, oh, that's a groovy thing, man. Why play four on the floor when you can play eight on the floor? I might have done it with a tom-tom or something else, but in essence, that beat goes back to watching James play that day.
The feeling through several of the Mr. songs that I was to really keep it rolling. It's like you're doing the 16th note thing, chicka chicka cha 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 cha. Then your hands are just occupied on the hi-hat. But no, so you're trying to move it around more. And again, using these additional, is it just that the electronic pads? It seems like you had more than just the one that you use now. You had several in that live setup.
In the Mr.'s days, one pad was one sound. By the end of the Mr.'s, there were a few things like the J.L. Cooper sound chest that I spent $5,000 to buy. And I could burn my own EEPROM chips, like the snare from Currier and stuff. So that had two sounds per pad. Well, now, as you can imagine, you can have a pad that has a thousand. It's whatever you want that pad to. But in those days, no, it was wired directly in. So that's why there were so many pads around the drum kit in those days. Plus, I don't really like to be seen. I'd be happy to play in the dark. You know, this thing where we put Crimson drummers in the front a few years ago, it was not my idea. I'm very happy in the back.
Let me play the riff going into the chorus. So not only the thicket that you create in the chorus itself with the sort of extra snare-ish use of the pad, I just thought that was, you know, for someone known for his drum prowess that you chose da 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 as your riff to go into this chorus.
I am a Neanderthal drummer. I've fooled enough people that they think I do a lot of things I don't do. It's a hybrid of a drum machine and some production skills or the ability to have a home studio. Some of these things I would do 30 years ago, but I had to have an engineer's help. Now I can just be on my own and figure it out. I tell you something else about Life Goes On, I'm thinking about it now too, is it's almost constantly has an offbeat hi-hat. So that really pushes the song to me. I think, what can a human add to the song? What can a machine do for the song? How can I take the best of both? So, you know, for the consistency and different reasons you want a drum machine, for the spontaneity and more energy and ability to uplift sections, you need a human. So I try to use what I have in my vocabulary, musical vocabulary, you know?
Keeping the momentum going like that, like you're talking about with the cymbal, when you stop to do a tom riff, it's too easy. Like, we've had a nice little steady thing going on here. And now, oh, wait, I got to stop to go do, 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 you know, but somehow the way that you, maybe it's just the engineering, but you keep it a very consistent feel so that it's not like the little thing that now we're interrupting with, you know, it's just a change of color, let's say, to get into the next section.
Yeah, but that's just a tricky thing. You don't want groovist interruptus. That's the worst.
There you go.
And I know what you're talking about. It's also because I tend to play, I'm a bit louder, I'm a bit more, you know, I'm ham-fisted. I don't play many, in most contexts, I don't play many double strokes. I play single strokes. So I have more powerful, more volume, more power, less finesse. That's the trade, you know. And if I play with a certain intensity and then go for a finesse fill or finesse chops, it can't bring the energy down. It can't bring the volume down. I mean, I talk about drummers like Danny Carey and Gavin and stuff. When you go on stage and you play too hard, too strong, too loud at the beginning, you realize, oh man, I got to keep this up for 2 hours. I can't let it go. The energy goes down. You have to pace yourself. You have to start at 60 miles an hour so you can still go to 100. You know what I'm saying? So if you hit the stage at 100 miles an hour, you know, we're going to kill them tonight. You get out there and you go, well, I'm exhausted and I can't keep the backbeats or, you know, if you're looking at the monitor level, they're probably going down in volume. Every song is getting weaker. He's getting weaker.
I think it was Richie Ramone I was talking to that was in his book was emphasizing how you could sort of tell the good drummers from the bad drummers that the bad drummers, they hit the cymbals too hard. The cymbals are going to be louder in the first place. And so like being monstrous on, you know, and of course the Ramones are not known for their subtlety, but that translated to him as being monstrous on the toms and the snare. But then when you're hitting the crash, just somehow now we're being delicate because the cymbals are already loud by themselves.
Yep, he's absolutely right. And that's the trick. The hi-hat is the worst, even worse. You know, the amount of hi-hat bleed most guys get into their snare drum mix. So just the volume that most of us play our hi-hat is much too loud for recording.
And do you sometimes use electronic cymbals, I use in quotes, in order to bypass that you can actually control the mix exactly if you're going all electronic?
Yeah, but I wouldn't probably use it to be a cymbal. A cymbal is a difficult instrument to sample and play back and have it be fluid. There's the new, you know, DW drums, drum workshop drums. They're acoustic drums. They're making electric drums now. They've got a flagship thing that's just coming out. So on this upcoming tour with Tuner, I'm going to use the electronic kick and snare and toms, but I'm probably not going to use the cymbals. Because I've been working with them here at the house for the last month. They're just not quite there yet for me. And the pad you have to play to trigger the cymbal, they've made a metal pad that looks like a cymbal, but it sounds like you're hitting a wall. It's so freaking loud. I wish you were here in the room with me. I could explain it easier, but that's the adjustment I'm going to have to make here.
Back in the Mr. days, nobody was thrusting electronic cymbals on you. That it was always just, you know, you got your pads, that is the individual thing, but you're going to play real cymbals. That's going to...
Absolutely. Although there was a couple sounds I liked inside what was a Simmons. They were Simmons drums mostly in those days. The Lindrum were complete shit. But Simmons had these metallic, more like a bell sound and a sound, things like that. Like the beginning of Broken Wings. That's there's kind of a, before it starts, there's like a hiss. It goes, doon, doon, doon. Well, that little hiss, that's a Simmons cymbal, kind of a pink, white noise thing that I hit and faded in. So there's no attack on it. So I use things like that, alternatives to cymbals.
Well, to wrap up here, I wanted to play a little bit of Stickmen, your project with Marcus and with Tony Levin. The song Prog Noir is what Marcus had recommended that we cover here. We're going to introduce it and then just say goodbye, and then folks will be able to hear that. But in addition to hearing Tony sing, which is fun, that is not, you know, normally shown as a lead singer, but I mean, the title of the tune sort of says what the tone is. Do you tend to title these after they're composed, or was this... sort of intentional, do you recall?
I think that one already had a title. Tony had gone to Germany to try and write with Marcus, and he was there in the dark, gloomy time of winter, and he came back with this idea of prog noir, that we make a dark prog record. And that was one of the first pieces he had. And what's interesting for me about that track, if you're playing it off the original record, you know, school record's called Prog Noir. See, that track was just a bass riff when I did the drums. Tony had sent me, don, don, David, don, whatever the bass riff is. And I had gone in to cut a track for Patty Griffith, I think. Engineer is Mike McCarthy. And he had a really good drum sound. Maybe it was a different session, but it was with Mike McCarthy. And I said, Mike, can I just cut this extra track? I'll just do one take while we're here at your session. And it was the bass riff Tony had given me. So I played that drum take start to finish, but there were no vocals. There was no anything. So if you'll notice, after maybe, I don't know, 16 times, I do a tom fill. And another 16 times, I go over onto the cymbal for a while. And then maybe I thought, well, let's put some chokes. And I figured when the song was written, we would move these things around and go, oh, we'll use the chokes for the bridge. But they didn't. So every drum event that happens, everything in that piece, it's somewhat random. They were never meant to fit with whatever's going on top. And I just watched this Rick Beato with, who's the other drum hero? The young boy. Yeah, I don't want to. He's in the Foo Fighters now. He was such a youngster when I first met him.
Is it Josh Fries?
Yeah, Josh. Josh was just saying the same thing about A Perfect Circle song. He said that he cut the drums when it was just a demo and that he loves it because all the drum fills are in the wrong places because there was no song. The same thing for me with Prog Noir. There's events that happen because I just chose to do them. There was no other musical element to play along with me when I did it.
That's an interesting, atypical, you know, thing for this Stickmen sort of noted as it's three guys playing live and actually responding to each other. No, you're not responding. It wasn't even there. Although I noticed you guys did release some other a work in progress. I'll just link folks to. Was this with Tuner, where you just released like the various versions you sent to each other in succession? I'll delete this if I'm...
Oh, yeah. That was originally was called, I think we call it Smudge.
Or was this a Stickmen thing? This was you and Tony.
It was me and Tony and Marcus. You know, what happened was I thought it was interesting because we passed files how much a song changes. The most featured element in the beginning somehow later becomes gets diluted by all the overdubs. So yeah, I posted that online where I put Tony's first version, the drums, I put them back and forth and the emails so you could follow the progression, I guess was my joke. It's like the progression. How do you write a song? Well, this is how we write a song. Tony sends this part. I do that part. We send this to Marcus and here's the dialogue that goes with it. You know, I like this, but I don't like that. But why did you do that? Or why didn't you do this? And
I'll link to folks to that. You know, it's entirely an extension of what I'm trying to do on this show. So folks can pursue that on their own.
Because it's such a simple song. At one point, I remember in my email text, I said, it sounds like I'm playing a Leo Sayer song. And it really did. So.
All right. Well, thanks so much for doing this. It was just a pleasure walking through your very diverse catalog. I will link from the blog post associated with this to Tunisia and to many of the other projects that we've mentioned over the hour here to Level 5, etc. Yeah. Any final words for the people?
Just enjoy your life, Mark, you know?
All right.
Have a good day. Have a good week. Good year.
All right. Here it is. Prog Noir by Stickmen. Again. Thanks so much to Pat. I've now completed my tuner trifecta with both Trey Gunn and Marcus Reuter on this show before. I've been trying to get Tony Levin for a long time. Maybe that'll happen someday, but he's a very, very busy guy. I recorded this back in April with Pat. He got bumped by Richard Thompson because of record label issues. So I appreciate everyone's patience in getting this episode out. What a very fun, talented guy. You should look to patmostolato.com to learn more. And look to the blog post associated with this episode at nakedlyexaminedmusic.com. I will link to some of Pat's other projects and a lot of live footage. I have episodes already recorded with Oliver Wakeman and Ja Wobble, and am now taking a bit of a break so that I can get those released before I acquire too many more. If you have guest suggestions or comments about the show, I'd love to hear from you, mark@nakedlyexaminedmusic.com. And please be sure you are subscribed to the Nakedly Examined Music podcast directly, even if you're hearing this on the Partially Examined Life feed or YouTube or elsewhere. I would also very much appreciate a nice rating or a review if you're up to it when you're at Apple Podcasts or anywhere else. In fact, there's a widget that guides you right through the review process at nakedlyexaminedmusic.com in the upper right-hand corner. And of course, I appreciate your support. Patreon.com/nakedlyexaminedmusic. You'll get every episode ad-free. You'll get a little bit of bonus stuff. You'll get the detailed notes that I take for each episode that lay out the structure of the songs, make a lot of comments that I don't even get around to making during the interviews themselves. Folks using Apple Podcasts can also just click that little paid subscription button, and that'll get you on the paid plan for not only this podcast, but also my Pretty Much Pop and Flossy versus Improv podcasts, which is nice. Hope you're enjoying the summer, getting out and seeing some music, maybe playing some music. But in any case, keep on musicking. This is Mark Linsenmeyer signing off.